Indeed, the individualism and the faith in equality of opportunity, which typified Jacksonian democracy, were also dominant factors in the industrial age after the Civil War. These ideas not only helped shape the era, but persisted, according to the belief of many reformers, long after they had any relation to reality. They lasted until, ironically, individualism contributed to the exploitation of the millions, and when a belief in equality of opportunity helped make possible its reverse, the grossest inequality. Although the political and economic thinking of the Jackson period continued to a remarkable vitality in later periods, the history of the era between the Civil War and the Spanish-American War can be encompassed by no term as simple as democratization. There were other, more important factors which warrant examination tonight. Industrialization, social Darwinism, urbanization, unionism, agrarianism, and finally imperialism. These, added to what went before, were additional historic forces which have not only molded our own century, but are still highly significant factors in the year 1950. All these new forces grew out of the concrete economic reality that during the second half of the 19th century, the United States was changing from a predominantly agricultural nation into the greatest industrial power in the world. Industry triumphed over agriculture, and of necessity, major maladjustments and readjustments followed. The tremendous growth of industry was not, of course, an American factor alone. It was a great shift in Western civilization, a cycle of change, which, with all of its accompanying blessings and evils, had swept England and Belgium decades earlier, and which, parallel to the United States, was remolding Imperial Germany. Elsewhere, as in the United States, it brought problems of relationships of the new industrialists to government, of capital to labor and agriculture, of the phenomenal growth of cities with their fine homes and squalid slums, and of the quest for overseas areas for economic exploitation. Between 1860 and 1900, the United States jumped from fourth to first place among the manufacturing nations of the world, and by 1900, its output exceeded that of its two nearest rivals, Great Britain and Germany. Customarily, Americans have attributed this phenomenal growth to the Civil War, this Second American Revolution, as Charles Beard called it, which shifted the political hegemony from the master of the plantation to the master of the factory. Yet in the history of American industrialization, the Civil War is as much an effect as a contributing factor. It marked the first great triumph, and it paved the way for succeeding ones. This is not to rule out slavery as a factor in bringing on the war, nor to discount the blunders of a generation of inept politicians. Long before secession, the North, in factories and farms, in cities and rural population, in railroads and in total wealth, was far ahead of the South. Yet the Southern minority, clinging to control of the federal government, was managing to perpetuate a national economic program favorable to the interests of the plantation owners. Growth of population in the North, made possible in part at least by the rapid development of factories and railroads, this growth made inevitable its capture of the federal government. When this triumph seemed close at hand with the election of Abraham Lincoln, the South seceded, and in so doing, since it lost the ensuing war, it abdicated its control over national economic policies. The Republican politicians, representing uneasy coalitions of Northern farmers, railroaders, industrialists, and bankers, during the Civil War pushed through Congress the program that the South had so vigorously opposed. A high protective tariff to assist fledgling manufacturers, heavy subsidies for Northern railroad construction, which at the time farmers as well as railroad men considered a boon, and a Homestead Act, which supposedly meant the distribution of free farms in the West. In final analysis, these and similar measures were of little value to the farmer, but were of tremendous benefit to businessmen. Legislatively, they won the Civil War before the Battle of Bull Run, and never relinquished their gains. Economically, the war itself was a bonanza that provided many of them with the initial stake with which to engage in the building of huge fortunes in the post-war years. The pompous House of Morgan has opened its archives to prove untrue the old story that J.P. Morgan made a sizable sum selling condemned guns back to the government. There was fraud enough in war contracts. The very word shoddy survives as the appellation of a certain sort of contractor and the kind of cloth he sold the government. Lint mixed with glue and felted into cloth for uniforms. Cloth substantial only until the first rainstorm. It was not necessary to be a shoddy manufacturer in order to make large profits. Small iron manufacturers who almost went bankrupt during the Depression of the 50s enjoyed great prosperity through filling large war orders. Banking firms like that of Morgan could gain enormously merely through speculation in gold and foreign exchange, which, if not patriotic, was at least legal. And after the war, Morgan had the requisite capital with which to begin building an enormous financial empire, while another young man, associated with several of the iron masters, Andrew Carnegie, was financially able to quit his job with the Pennsylvania Railroad in order to give his entire time to the iron and steel industry. Capital had always been short in America. After the Civil War, it was present in the sizable quantities necessary for large-scale enterprise. The larger part of it came from the tremendous governmental outpouring of money, whether inflated greenbacks or borrowed funds, and this flowed into railroads and industry. Heavy governmental borrowing did not dry up capital within the United States, for nearly $1 billion of European funds went into government bonds. Another $500 million came from Europe in subsequent years to help finance railroads. This European capital, going into what appeared to be safe and sure American investments, released American capital for risky enterprises, which, if successful, would produce huge returns. The young men who manipulated risk capital took tall chances. Many of them gambled and lost, but some won huge fortunes, and along with them, acclaim as the builders of industrial America. They became the great men of the age. Few poor boys in the 80s and 90s wanted to grow up to be a drab president like Benjamin Harrison when they had the dazzling example before them of a multimillionaire philanthropist like Andrew Carnegie. Horatio Alger's heroes did not wind up in the White House. They wound up in the counting house. The growth of the railroad serves as a good example of the way in which most large-scale business developed during this era. In the boom years from 1866 to 1873, railway mileage in the United States doubled, and railway construction directly and indirectly stimulated a variety of other American industries. As late as the 1890s, over a fifth of pig iron was going into railroad bars. Consequently, railroad construction, as it rose or fell, ran slightly ahead of other industrial output and served as an index of economic conditions in the country as a whole. As in other fields, the first railroad builders were hardy men with an knack for getting things done. They knew how to deal with laborers, politicians, and local citizens. They could command confidence in open sources of credit. With equal adroitness, they could fix a wheezy locomotive or a balky legislature. As railroad problems came to center increasingly around finance, around the raising of large sums, power often shifted from engineering promoters like Theodore Judah, to financial and legal experts like Leland Stanford. These began new construction to win stock exchange battles, as well as to beat out rivals for trade areas. But in turn, their financial manipulations helped develop modern stock exchanges and stimulated the growth of investment banking and security brokerage. Another practice of theirs, by the way, was an American innovation which has continued to be highly important to industry. Many of the lines they first constructed were so flimsy that when profits came in, to the distress of stockholders, railroads used much of the money, not for dividends, but for the improvement of lines. Finally, when the railroads had become going concerns, they did contribute materially to the total national wealth. They provided transportation service for areas which otherwise could not have existed commercially. But they charged such high rates that many of these areas, especially when they were agricultural, could barely exist commercially with the railroads. Rate structures were highly discriminatory, if not predatory. There were some instances where they were as much as four times higher west of the Missouri River or south of the Ohio, and rate discrimination has been a continuing complaint of the South and the West. Where railroads enjoyed monopoly conditions, they charged as much as the traffic would bear, although this sometimes meant more for a short haul than for a long one. They could charge more to haul grain from the Dakotas to Minneapolis than the charge by rail and steamship combined from Chicago to Liverpool. Where natural monopoly did not exist and competition ate into profits, they could form pools to divide the traffic and keep rates up. But then there was too much temptation to gain an advantage in more freight by giving secret rebates to large shippers. Pools, consequently, failed more often than not, and railroads tried the more effective methods of trusts, holding companies, and mergers as a means of seeking the same monopoly ends. The first American holding company, incidentally, was a creature of the Pennsylvania Railroad. It was the Southern Railway Securities Company, established in 1869. Its president was a man named James Roosevelt. By the 1880s and 90s, railways that had been daring pioneer enterprises only a decade or so earlier had often become mature economic institutions, complex in organization and operation, representing large investments, and dedicated to perpetuating a safe return on these. The day of the promoter, dedicated primarily to the taking of large risks for great gain, was waning, and most railroad executives were slowly making their way up through the ranks or quickly succeeding to their father's fortunes, and were concentrating upon sound conservative practice. Bankers had an increasing hand in this institutionalization. When chronically mismanaged roads went into bankruptcy in the 1890s, as did the Erie, so frequently and thoroughly looted by Jay Gould, Jubilee Jim Fisk, and Uncle Dan Drew, only Wall Street bankers could command the large sums necessary for financial rehabilitation. The bankers were willing to provide the capital, but only if, for the protection of their investors, they could have a voice in the management. Thus, J.P. Morgan, the banker, gained a decisive voice in the running of Erie. And thus, too, Wall Street control came to reach out in every direction and gave rise to what reformers in the early 1900s customarily denounced as the money trust. The cycle in railroads applied to industry as a whole. Where the innovator or promoter had no patent or did not have any natural monopoly to exploit, cutthroat competition could destroy his profits and in time of depression lead to bankruptcy. The way out was to create a monopoly by seizing the bottleneck in the industry, whatever it might be, and just get rid of competitors preparatory to raising prices. John D. Rockefeller gained control over transportation and refineries, and through them built his great Standard Oil Trust. Andrew Carnegie, through more efficient management, through savings that came from owning coal mines and coke ovens as well as steel mills, and through superior salesmanship, sold more iron and steel at greater profits than his competitors. In times of prosperity, he piled up cash reserves, and from the 70s on, made the depressions work for him, as did most of the other empire builders. Carnegie once explained how he took care of his friends during the panic of 1873. He said, "So many of my friends needed money that they begged me to repay them. I did so and bought out five or six of them. That was what gave me my leading interest in this steel business." But by the end of the century, the steel, oil, and other empires were built and were following conservative policies that would bring them a modest return of 10% or so on their huge investments. For the majority of Americans, these giant combinations brought distress, or irritation at least, rather than profits and prosperity. True, the living standard of the average citizen did continue to rise and became the highest in the world. But debt-ridden farmers and underpaid laborers benefited little, and consumers as a whole by the end of the century felt they received comparatively little savings from the mechanization and large-scale enterprise that was supposed to benefit them. To give one concrete example close to home, the Champaign-Urbana laborer of 1884, earning $1.50 a day, certainly could have had no illusions about Mr. Rockefeller's oil trust. For while bread cost 5 cents a loaf and beef roast cost 12 cents a pound, kerosene was 20 cents a gallon, a figure comparable to that of today. There were protests against conditions like these, and vigorous protests too, from embattled farmers, laborers, and reformers. To the turn of the century, however, they were far from successful in their demands. There were numerous reasons for their failure, of which one of the most important was that most Americans wholeheartedly believed in and endorsed the system which brought about the domination of the industrialists.